Welcome to Cybersecurity Where You Are, the Center for Internet Security's podcast. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO at CIS.
And I'm Tony Sager, Senior Vice President and Chief Evangelist at CIS. Cybersecurity affects us all, whether we're online at home, managing a company, supporting clients, or running a state or local government.
So join us on Wednesdays as we discuss trends and threats, explore security best practices, and interview experts in the industry.
Together, we'll clarify these issues, creating confidence in the connected world.
Hello, and welcome to the show, Cybersecurity Where You Are. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO here at the Center for Internet Security, joined by a podcast regular, Mr. John Cohen. John, how are you, sir?
Hey, Sean. Great to be with you again.
Fantastic. Great to have you back. And also returning, Caitlin Drape. Caitlin, how are you?
Good. Thank you, Sean. Good to be back as well.
Fantastic. So we're going to talk about the actualization of threat intelligence, how we bring threat intelligence into an operational element, really, how that makes sense in terms of us being able to, one, utilize that information judiciously, one, to build protection profile, a defensive capability, and even reaction in as close to real time in terms of our ingestion of threat intelligence to really bolster our underlying defensive program. So, John, I really want to start off, you know, we'll start laying the foundation, as it were, of this podcast by understanding what actualizing threat intelligence means in today's cybersecurity landscape. I want to get your thoughts there.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really important question and issue, Sean. And I look at this, even though I've worked in the intelligence community, I've run an intelligence organization, but my background is in law enforcement and security operations. And in my mind, the value that comes from intelligence is not simply just telling a story, but telling the story in a way that allows someone who's responsible for protecting a facility, protecting people, protecting systems, people who are involved in investigations, can use that intelligence in a way that helps to inform effective operational activities. And I think it also influences the analysis in a second way, right? So the first way is, when you're producing a piece of information on a threat, your objective isn't just to say to have the consumer be afraid, here's a threat, be afraid, but is to provide the consumer of that intelligence the answer to two other questions. Why is this important and what can you do about it? The other place where it comes into play, and this is something I really learned at Department of Homeland Security, is simply providing information on threat is important, but not enough. It reminded me of a story as I was thinking about this podcast. It reminded me of a story where a member of the intelligence community sent out this threat alert regarding the report that a certain terrorist organization wanted to conduct an attack against several aviation facilities located across the globe. And it caused quite a stir amongst the national security community within the federal government. But what we did at DHS is we took that threat intelligence, which was collected through highly sensitive collection means, and we compared it to information that TSA and Customs and Border Patrol had because they had a presence in those aviation facilities. And what we found out is while the threat intelligence was very disconcerting, that all the airports that had been mentioned in that intelligence had already taken steps to mitigate the potential of that type of threat being able to be successfully carried out. So while the threat was significant, the risk actually wasn't. Because while there was threat, the vulnerability of the facility to that threat had been pretty much mitigated. So I think that's the other important thing. It's, intelligence is most valuable when it helps operational people take steps to protect against a threat. And threat intelligence is more valuable when it is looked at in conjunction with information on vulnerability and consequence, and you're able to assess risk.
Exactly. John, it aligns to this thought is threat intelligence by itself. You've got to take that intelligence and bring operational intelligence to really get the value and understand the context. As you mentioned, the risk assessment Because in some cases, you know, we see threat intelligence generic, you know, from other providers, and it has no relevance. You know, why am I ingesting it? Why, you know, I've just taken the time to assess it, doesn't apply to me. And that becomes threat awareness, not necessarily threat intelligence. And I think there's a huge difference between those two elements. And, this question comes up and really wanted to assess those thoughts in the context of both an organization, one, misunderstanding that concept, but then also the underutilization. Because, John, Caitlin, I just want to put this forward, is there's the kind of the alarmist approach. But if you go through all threat intelligence with the same veracity, you become nullified, right? Numb to it necessarily. And it doesn't help actualize really a true intelligence approach to integration. Caitlin, I'll start with you there. Just wanted to get your thoughts on underutilization and potentially misunderstanding the utility of threat intelligence.
Yeah, it's a great question. And first I'll say that, you know, I think as physical and cyber threats become more complex and targeted and, you know, have more of a hybrid element, threat intelligence for any organization is really no longer a nice to have. It's really essential. And I think it's often underutilized, perhaps maybe because it's a bit, you know, overwhelming for some organizations if it's not, you know, really part of their business strategy or their bottom line. It can often be fragmented and sort of hard to translate into action, sort of what John was talking about. So, while there's no shortage of data from whether it be a government alert or from the private sector, there's really no kind of unified format. And I think it's tough for security leaders to connect the dots or even know if multiple reports are talking about the same threat actor, for example. And many organizations may also kind of dive in too deep, too quickly, and may not account for the time or the bandwidth that it takes to assess the data. So I think that, you know, internal incidents and logs can provide a lot of valuable intelligence, but, you know, many just aren't collecting it adequately and analyzing it effectively. And without those internal insights, even the best kind of external data won't connect. So I think ultimately to get real value, companies need to build strong processes first, and then kind of layer in that external intelligence more strategically. So it's not about having the data, it's knowing how to use it and kind of taking a measured and sort of qualified approach to utilizing it.
But it's also, Sean, how you present the intelligence so that it resonates with key decision makers, right? So, you know, one of the things that we're learning here at CIS is that the highly technical cyber threat alerts are extraordinarily valuable to those who have operational responsibility for protecting systems, right? And where we can provide, you know, highly technical data on a piece of malware or some other mechanism that's being used by a cyber threat actor to conduct a cyber attack, that's important to them. If you provide that information to a police chief, a sheriff, a Homeland Security advisor, or a mayor, they're not going to understand it, and it's not going to resonate with them, and therefore it's not going to be a priority. So what we've sought to do is to blend, as Caitlin was saying, to blend in our reporting, that highly technical information that the people working in the CISO's office or the CIO office will need to make the necessary protections within the information environment or the communication system environment so they can protect against attack or find if they've been penetrated already, but also then communicate it in a way so that the mayor, governor, police chief will also understand the threat. And sometimes that's talking about things that from a cyber threat perspective, maybe we're not that in the past haven't been that comfortable. And that's the outcome of the cyber attack. A denial of service attack against a 911 center may be a relatively simple thing for a cyber intelligence person or a CISO to fix, right? And to mitigate. But the harm that comes from a 911 center being shut down, even if it's for just several hours, is something that a different group of people within that city government are going to have to be able to mitigate and communicate to the public about. And that's where cybersecurity is now going. It's one that cyber attacks are now very often, as Caitlin pointed out, conducted, you know, in synergy with physical attacks or with information operations. And then secondly, cyber incidents are no longer just simply a technical issue that's dealt with by the technologist. It's something that can impact the delivery of emergency and non-emergency service, can impact, you know, investigations, can impact the security of a community. And so they have to be understood, and there are steps that have to be taken that fall outside of the responsibilities of the CISO.
Yeah. Well, I love that, John, because it sets both a perspective that can be shared through an organization. Some cases, you know, let's say I escalate a certain incident through the organization, I get some telemetry, but if I can communicate that to different compartments necessarily of the organization from a strategic, tactical, and operational perspective, really feel that that has such a difference in terms of one, reaction, two, support, an ability to really get more support through those processes to both understand, one, this life cycle necessarily of the integration of this type of telemetry, but then also how that intelligence is permeated through an organization really, I think, becomes key to some other questions that we'll get to. And I mentioned that we'll get to those because I want to talk about maturation, reactive to proactive threat intelligence, and collaboration. But we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back to get John and Caitlin's answers to those questions.
Are you a U.S. state, local, tribal, or territorial government?
If so, you know just how difficult cyber defense can get.
You're the frontline defense against cyber threats, yet you don't have the shiny tools, big budget, or skilled talent of an enterprise.
Well, guess what? You don't need them.
You do need a community of like-minded folks to unlock the power of collective cybersecurity.
And that's the superpower of the Multi-State Information Sharing and Analysis Center.
The Multi-State ISAC provides cyber underserved organizations with protections they otherwise couldn't afford at a price that works for them.
But it's more than just access to services. It's access to a community of peers where your participation protects them and theirs protects you.
Not to mention access to the 24/7/365 CIS Security Operations Center as your full-time public sector cybersecurity partner.
Available as a single organization or state or territory-wide option, the MSISAC membership provides threat intelligence, monitoring, and more to fortify your cyber defense.
Become a member today by visiting cisecurity.org/ms-isac.
Okay, welcome back. John, you know, I always come to you for stories. You've got the best story. So I just want to ask you about where you've seen threat intelligence really make a difference in a security incident that you've either seen, heard of, or even been part of.
Yeah, there's a lot of stories. I will tell you one of my favorites. So this isn't cyber related, but I think it's one of the most interesting sort of threat mitigation success stories that I've been at least been a part of. So back in the 2011-2012 timeframe, the intelligence community received intel that that a surgeon had been hired by Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and that people had traveled to Yemen and were having explosive devices surgically implanted into their bodies. They were then going to travel to a regional airport, fly to a last point of departure airport, then these multiple people would get on planes bound for the United States, and simultaneously these explosives would go off. And for a whole bunch of reasons, which we probably don't have time to go into, from the perspective of deployment of explosive devices, it was a brilliant plan. The intelligence community assessed it was a credible threat. We began tracking, you know, so we brought together people from across DHS and the rest of the intelligence community, but also from the medical community. And we came together and we started figuring out, okay, so if you were able to surgically implant an explosive device in somebody, how long would that explosive device be viable until the body's own chemistry would start breaking it down? How long would a battery stay, you know, charged so the device could work? What would be the outward signs? What would be the physical signs that a person would exhibit if they had an explosive device, you know, with certain types of compounds being used in their body? So we figured all of that out. And literally within 24 hours, we had airport security folks around the world in these airports that we thought were viable targets for last point of departure, trained on what to look for. We had protocols put in place so that, I mean, you can't just like take somebody to a hospital who may have a viable explosive device inside of their body because it could blow up in the hospital. So we had mitigation plans put in place on how to deal with it. We also began a very aggressive effort to target with drones the AQAP people at the locations where they were present. And in about 72 hours, we went from a period of time where we were highly concerned that we were going to have an explosive incident on a plane to having mitigated the threat. So that's an example of how intelligence came in. We were able to develop additional intelligence by bringing in traditional and non-traditional expertise to understand how the threat would manifest itself, you know, ranging from travel potential, you know, likely as travel routes to, as I mentioned before, the physical manifestations of the threat. We were able to quickly take that information and put in place mitigation plans. And within a relatively short time period, we went from being concerned about an explosive incident on an airplane bound for the United States to having mitigated the threat.
Wow. That's incredible. Again, if you ever need a story, John Cohen, I mean,
By the way, those who are listening and who are saying, wait a minute, that sounds like something we saw from one of the Batman movies. We actually believe that that's where the bomb maker got the idea.
Wow. Wow. Incredible. Now, Caitlin, my other question here, talking about maturation of a threat intelligence program. So the way I did that was to talk to you. Now, not every organization has a Caitlin to be able to do some threat modeling, collaboration on threat intelligence and assessment. But what do you think are some of the key components an organization requires in order to mature a threat intelligence program?
Yeah, thanks, Sean. So I kind of thought about this a lot. And I think, you know, to start like at a very basic level, and you talk about this a lot too, kind of knowing what your crown jewels are first and knowing what threats actually matter to you and your organization. So this means prioritizing based on internal assets, industry risks, past incidents. Those are just to name a few. And then I think from there, you know, the program can and should evolve with a few other key steps. So what is your organization, again, trying to protect above anything else? Focus on what's most relevant for your business. From a cyber perspective, is it ransomware, data theft, insider threats, critical infrastructure? And then, you know, if it's physical threats, what infrastructure is most at risk, or your people, and where do those emanate from? What types of threat actors? And then what is going to have the most cascading impacts for your customers or your people? And then kind of think about how you can use threat intelligence to highlight, you know, which adversaries are most likely to target you and why. Also very important to build and mature your program with cross collaboration in mind. So really make sure to integrate across teams. Threat intelligence cannot sit in a silo. You know, we really focus on that a lot too on CHT. So it really needs to flow into other teams, whether that's incident response, you know, vulnerability management, even executive strategies. So cross-functional workflows really ensure that intelligence is actionable, in my opinion. And then leverage your data, both internal and then any external feeds you can, you know, kind of get your hands on. So your own logs, systems, and past incidents are really going to be gold mines. Use those to establish a baseline to detect anomalies. And then kind of like I spoke about earlier, you know, layer in that external intelligence. But one, it's really about kind of getting those internal processes quite solid, in my opinion, and then kind of integrating from trusted commercial, government, and industry sources. And then lastly, you know, just continuing to drive improvement or continuous improvement on your plan. So, you know, after each incident, conducting after actions or kind of a post-mortem, you know, what did the threat actor do? How did your systems respond? How did your people respond? And kind of feedback that insight into your team and also cross-functionally. So, you know, in short, I think a really mature threat intel program is, you know, really about kind of training your people, having those internal processes, and then, you know, having your technologies validated and working, of course, at a very basic level. So,
and Sean, if I can add to that, what Caitlin and her colleagues in countering hybrid threats do really well are several things. One, in addition to everything she described, they look at the world not just through the lens of the target, but through the lens of the adversary, right? So they're thinking, what are the objectives of foreign intelligence services like those from Russia, China, Iran? What are they trying to accomplish? What do foreign terrorist groups try and accomplish? How are they using cyber to, you know, cyber attacks, information operations, physical threats in an integrated way to achieve their strategic and tactical objectives? How are criminal organizations using those same type of attack techniques? So they're not just looking at the world, you know, in a scattershot way where they prioritize certain threat actors because these are the threat actors that are most active. And then they're looking through the world through their eyes. The second thing they do, and I think one of the things that I have found that the analytic community has struggled with is they don't just simply report on what they see. They report on what they see, but through the context of helping provide greater insight into potential targets of attack and the tactics that will be used by the attacker. Why is that important? Because that allows those in law enforcement or the security world to prioritize where they put their operational resources. So if you're getting intelligence that, you know, a state actor from overseas wants to conduct a cyber attack against the United States, just stating that isn't all that helpful. And that's something we often see from the analytic community. It's pulling from the information you're analyzing any insights on targets and tactics that can then be used to develop mitigation measures. The other thing that Caitlin said, which I think is so critically important, and this is something that we're beginning to do increasingly at CIS, is bringing in the non-intelligence groups into the discussions. The reason we were able to mitigate the surgically implanted explosive devices back, you know, in 2011, 2012, is because we not only brought in people who could see the intelligence, but they also brought in people who understood explosives, who understand medical procedures, understood how certain chemicals interact with the body. What we're doing now at CIS, when we produce, you know, our weekly threat roundup, ThreatWA, which is available to people through subscription, or we produce our other reports, is we'll bring in people from security best practices. We'll bring in people from your shop. We'll bring in people from the different product who represent the different products and services at CIS, and included in our products is a description of how you can apply the security controls or other services and tools that CIS provides into mitigating the threat we're reporting.
Absolutely, John. You know, one of the things that I see as critical that you've both hit on is really this an ability to abstract that information to action. And by utilizing necessarily the thought leadership that you and the team bring, John and Caitlin, to the table, that I think is such a catalyst to allow us, one, to produce trusted threat intelligence product. And really move, John, into this thought where, as we start as an organization to bring in information, to work with your team, the MSISEC, with respect to their the intelligence that's shared through there, really starting to move from this element of reactive to proactive threat intelligence, I think is so important and something that I think needs to be distinguished between. Because sometimes what I've seen through other incidents at other organizations is this reactive approach where it's not threat intelligence, it's threat information, because it already happened and you're like, well, how did this happen? And you go back and review past threat intelligence. Oh, there it was identified 3 weeks ago. We didn't react to it. We didn't understand it. And now look where we are. John, I think there's a huge distinguishing fact there between reactive and proactive. But I want to get your thoughts on how an organization would move to actually ingest and utilize the intelligence really in an intelligent way.
Yeah, it goes to what we were talking about a little earlier. I mean, look, let's focus on the cyber world specifically. If you look at, you know, when I was the head of intelligence at DHS, I had a cyber threat team. They were very good at, once an incident occurred, understanding the technology used to carry out that cyber attack and then provide that to others, in the private sector and other government agencies, so they could go scan their systems and they could fine tune their firewalls or do whatever they could do to protect against being targeted or detect whether they had been compromised. And that's great. It's really important. It's sort of like why it's important to have plans and response protocols in place after a mass shooting and a bombing, because you can actually reduce the damage, reduce the harm, but you still have casualties, right? If you're reactive. What we also do now, and we're doing increasingly, is we're evaluating through our intelligence collection, what are the goals and objectives of the cyber threat actor? There's a lot of information that's out there that our team is looking at each and every day that provides advance warning about the types of locations that are going to be targeted and the types of attacks that are going to be conducted. And when I was at DHS, what I heard from CISOs and from chief security officers all the time is, don't just give me the technology after the fact, the technology information after the fact. Give me the information that allows me to understand what the intent is of the adversary, so I can place anomalies that I may be seeing within my network into the context of their strategic and tactical objectives. So we're trying to do more of that production now. We're trying to send out to those people who are MSISAC members or subscribers to ThreatWall information about what Iranian, Russian, Chinese, criminal-based hacking, cyber threat actors or hacking collectives, what they're trying to achieve, what message they're trying to send, what types of entities are they trying to target, so that, CISOs across the spectrum can place things that they see in context or proactively take steps to protect their infrastructures.
Wonderful. It makes so much sense, John, to think of it that way as really a construct that organizations should be adopting, respectfully. It kind of feels like a framework of, in some cases, direct action on ultimately a defensive objective, but in some cases, indirectly influencing an ability to react, respond, recover, and also conceptualize what is needed to run and support a complete infrastructure of this type of, threat target, underlying assets that need to be protected. And it leads me, Caitlin, to really think about the integration of taking that threat intelligence to an underlying life cycle. How does that then move through an organization? One, obviously, to be reinforced as a business process, but then also actionable objectives that have a positive outcome, both directly and indirectly, by following a representative life cycle. Any thoughts in that area, Caitlin?
Yeah, definitely. I think, and I'll hit home again on how critical cross-collaboration is when it comes to threat intelligence, because, the threat intelligence life cycle isn't just for intelligence or security analysts. It's really a cross-functional process that requires input and collaboration from multiple roles across an organization. So I think at varying stages, at the highest level, executive stakeholders are involved in that process because they're helping to define intelligence requirements in many ways because they're focused on business risks and strategic goals. So I think you do need those clear high-level insights to really make those decisions about risk management and for analysts to understand, you know, those crown jewels and threats to the organization, and that will kind of direct their priorities, right? And then obviously a huge component are the, you know, security analysts, threat intelligence teams. So they really lead that collection, processing, and analysis of threat data. But then they, you know, take it to that next level that John's been talking about, where it's translating that data into really actionable intelligence for their customers and for their internal teams. And then I think IT and infrastructure teams have obviously a huge role to play, you know, providing log data and insights from internal tooling, like, you know, endpoint detection or firewalls, things like that. And they are kind of that piece of implementing and communicating, you know, what defensive measures exist and are also based on, you know, the threat intelligence that's, you know, in theory being provided to them by the security teams.
So Sean, let me brag a little bit about Caitlin, okay?
Absolutely.
So Caitlin has led for CIS multiple sort of specific projects. You know, she was on the ground leading our efforts to help the state and local officials, you know, mitigate threats to the Democratic and Republican political conventions last summer. She did a lot of work on the election security related activities that we were involved in, including on election night, coordinating between the work that we were doing at CIS with the election community and the work we were doing at CIS on my team with law enforcement. She's also done similar type of collaboration for several major entertainment events and recently national level sporting events. What has she done in each of those cases? She's worked with the team and with local authorities to really understand the potential threats that could impact those events, you know, whether it be the election or, you know, a sporting event. They helped to bring clarity to the cyber information operation and physical threats that, and the warning signs that a threat like that could be materializing. She then worked with those same jurisdictions or entities to develop operational response plans to different scenarios represented by that threat, based on the analysis, based on the understanding of targets and tactics. She then helped them develop tabletop exercises. So once they developed an operational plan, which involved emergency managers, law enforcement, fire, EMS, cyber folks, you know, Homeland Security officials, they practiced it. They practiced it, right? And then while the events are taking place or during the period of time in which the activity she's supporting is taking place, she was working with the state and major urban area fusion centers and state and local law enforcement and others to identify and assess suspicious activities that were popping up, whether it be in the digital world or in the physical world, that were consistent with those threats. And there are examples where Caitlin and the team actually picked up activities online from overseas groups who were seeking to carry out physical threat-related activity in specific jurisdictions where an event was taking place. And they were able to get that information to law enforcement quickly, so they were able to proactively stop the threat-related activity from occurring, therefore reducing the potential that someone got hurt, reducing the potential that property got destroyed, reducing the opportunity that law enforcement were injured and there was disruptive effects. So that's how it becomes operational, right? It's understanding the threat. It's helping the impacted parties develop plans to address the threat. It's practicing those plans so that if the threat materializes, people are ready. It's understanding the suspicious activities that forewarn a threat is materializing and communicating rapidly upon detection of those suspicious activities, whether they're in a system or around a facility or involving a person, to mitigate the threat from materializing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as everything we've talked about, right, maturing a program, proactive life cycle, really all comes down to, one, both the intelligence being received and utilizing it in an intelligent way, and exemplified by Caitlin's work. And again, I'm a big fan. We work a lot together on building the program internally here as well. So I'm going to add that to her list of everything, all of your accomplishments.
I can't
Caitlin.
Take these compliments.
But it really.
But thank you.
No, 100%. Well deserved, because this is the difference. It really comes down to being able to actualize that type of intelligence through a program, one of understanding it in such a way, and you bring your expertise to do that across many different domains. And those, each domain has a volume of information in order to understand emergency management, crisis management, incident response strategies, forensics, all of these elements coming together to really build a program that I think shapes the future of threat intelligence, John, because it's not just one, let's say, contextual subject of cyber at this point. You and your team have really revealed to the world in terms of how this affects across many different kinetic threats, many different threat categories. And I, John, it leads us to this point is the future is not just thinking about the bytes, as it were, but the consequences of those bytes being shared across social network, across an underlying infrastructure, and the consequences that they can have, which really, I mean, it's up to the imagination what you can see. And even through your story that you provided, it's really how then we integrate that to utilize and build a capability. But I'll leave it with you, John, to think about how the future of threat intelligence is now shaping.
I think the good news is that, particularly at the state and local level, we are seeing the analytic capabilities that are resident in fusion centers, at, you know, in sheriff's offices and police departments, rise to the occasion. The level of sophistication is increasing. And because these are operational entities, you know, I'll tell you a story real quick. I left narcotics in my police department, and I became I worked in our department's intelligence division. And I just was really excited about being in that role. So I started writing all of these reports about drug trafficking trends and all this information that I was getting from reading federal documents and by talking to people conceptually. And after about 2 weeks, and I was really excited about all these reports I was producing, about 2 weeks into it, I get called into the captain's office. And this was a guy whose nickname was Cujo, named after the crazy dog that was killing. So that tells you a little bit about him. So I was a little bit nervous being called into the captain's office. He had this big stack of papers. He said, "These are all the reports that you've produced." I said, I know. And he says, "They're worthless." He said, "They're not going to help one person get arrested. And at the end of the day, what we do in law enforcement is we look for people engaged in criminal activity and we arrest them, prosecute them, and if appropriate, they're incarcerated." He says, "So when you write an intelligence report, don't just tell a story, but not include in that story why it's relevant and why it's going to help this members of this department do their job, which is to protect the streets of our community." And that really had a big impact on me. And all my subsequent, you know, other jobs that I've held in the intelligence community have really been driven and informed by that perspective. So that's how law enforcement thinks, right? It's not just about telling a story from an intelligence threat perspective, but it's telling that story in a way that allow for meaningful operational responses to that intelligence so that ultimately the communities they police are safer. And I would argue that we need to, the entire analytic community, whether they be private sector or public sector, federal, state, or local, need to embrace that idea that intelligence is only as good as the actions it helps to inform. And I think, again, at the state and local level, which is why we work so closely with state and local governments across the country, they are embracing that concept, and we're beginning to see dramatic changes for the better in the way that they gather, assess, analyze, and respond to information, threat information, whether it be cyber or physical.
And if I could just tack on another trend, just because we you know, I'm biased, but it's what I focus on, but that hybrid incidents are the new normal. You know, the line between physical and cyber threats have blurred. We're seeing more incidents that, you know, combine ransomware with data extortion or manipulated information with social engineering, and or whether it be cyber attacks that support geopolitical objectives or physical disruption, right? So threat intelligence now needs to connect the dots across domains, like John was saying, you know, cyber, physical, information, to really fully understand the adversary's intent and risk impact. So, you know, just ensuring that these communities understand that those types of threats are really here to stay, and responding to them appropriately.
Well, and for everybody listening, I will say that one of the most important concerns out there, whether you're a private sector company or a law enforcement organization, is the fact that criminal organizations are increasingly using cyber techniques to infiltrate systems, exfiltrate information, and then use that information for their own tactical purposes. There's a story that was recently put out by the Office of Inspector General of the Department of Justice, which described how an FBI official in Mexico, the cartel, one of the local cartels, recruited a hacker. They were able to compromise his phone. They were able to track his movements across the city. They hacked into the city's closed circuit TV system, their traffic cameras, their security cameras, other information systems. They ultimately were able to identify all the people he was meeting with, including those people they came to believe were informants, and they killed the informants. So they were able to disrupt investigations that were being conducted into their criminal activities. That's the new normal. They are going to be using those techniques, whether they be criminal organizations or terrorist organizations or foreign intelligence services. They are going to be using cyber techniques in a very tactical way to gather information about their intended targets, and they're going to use that information in order to inform their operational activities, which can include homicides.
Well, John, as usual, we've gone over our 30, but we can't help ourselves, right? It just so good. Again, Caitlin, John, thank you so much for being on the show. There's a lot more to talk about, so we're going to have you both back in the near term and continue this conversation. But thank you both so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sean.
Absolutely. And thank you to our audience. Appreciate you subscribing and listening. Make sure to subscribe on your preferred podcast platform. Catch us on YouTube at VCI Security. Questions, comments, concerns, podcast@cisecurity.org. Catch us every Wednesday for episodes like this and much, much more. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to the podcast today.
The thoughts and opinions expressed by our podcast guests are solely theirs and do not necessarily reflect those of CIS.
Tune in on Wednesdays for a new episode. And in the meantime, visit our website at cisecurity.org.
Together, we'll continue our efforts of creating confidence in the connected world.